schedule.
A lot of interesting things happen when you set an aggressive quota, even with ideas. People's competitive juices are stirred. Instead of panicking, they focus. And with that comes an increased fluency and agility of mind. People are also forced to suspend critical thinking. To meet the quota, they put their internal critic on hold and let everything out. They're no longer choking off good impulses. The most interesting thing I've noticed is that there's a consistent order to the quality of ideas. You'd think the 60th idea would be the most lame. But for my purposes, which are to trigger leaps of imagination, it's often the opposite. To meet the quota, people begin by listing the most obvious uses for a stool, such as sitting on it, standing on it, or burning it as fuel. These are the least original ideas. After that come the more imaginative uses. A doorstop, an anchor, a weapon, a projectile in a riot, as raw material for sculpture, as a surface to drum on. Then the final ideas come straggling in. As a surface for gymnastics, as a tool for taming lions, as a dancing partner. The closer they get to the 60th idea, the more imaginative they become because they have been forced to stretch their thinking. It's the same arc every time. The first third of the ideas are obvious, the second third are more interesting, the final third show flair, insight, curiosity, even complexity, as later thinking builds on earlier thinking. When you start with a stool, it's easy to think of a chair. Only after you see the chair can you think about it as a protective barrier between you and a lion. I'm not knocking first ideas. They're often the best, but they're rarely the most radical stretch, and that's the purpose of this exercise. I don't have to beat the audience over the head with the stool. They get the point. We get into ruts when we run with the first idea that pops into our head, not the last one. I've been doing this in real life for years in the studio. When I improvise alone or with a dancer to develop ideas for movement, I videotape the entire session. I want all of the session's ideas, good, bad, and ridiculous, captured without a filter. The only self-judgment imposed is whatever self-censoring my partner and I have placed on ourselves, and that's minimal because we know we're there to improvise and develop freely without restrictions. A 3-hour session sets an implicit quota of 3 hours worth of ideas. At day's end, I go through all 3 hours of tape, searching for a scrap of interesting movement that I've never seen before. If I find 30 seconds of movement out of the 3 hours, I'm happy. Interestingly, like the stool exercise, the useful ideas tend to come at the end of the session, when we're warmed up and have run through all the obvious steps. It never fails. But that doesn't mean I fast forward to the end. The process of getting to the good stuff is valuable, too. In fact, it's absolutely necessary. Sometimes you can't identify a good idea until you've considered and discarded the bad ones. This method is no different from a painter running through sketch after sketch until he gets something he likes. His studio floor is littered with crumpled sheets of rejected drawings. It's a lawn of false starts and mediocre solutions. But it's not a lawn of failure. The crumpled sheets are the cost of getting it right. In effect, the artist is running through his quota of 60 ideas for a sketch, only he doesn't know he has a quota. Challenging your assumptions is another important corrective procedure. If your car is in a rut, the first thing you do is put it in reverse to see if that provides better traction. Why not do the same to a stalled concept? Part of the excitement of creativity is the headlong rush into action when we latch onto a new idea. Yet in the excitement, we often forget to apply pressure to the idea, poke it, challenge it, push it around, see if it stands up. Without that challenge, you never know how far astray your assumptions may have taken you. I remember touring with my dance company in a van in the Midwest years ago. It was late in the afternoon. We were behind schedule and rushing to get to a performance at a college 250 miles north of Davenport, Iowa. We loaded the van, piled in, and somehow found the highway. About 30 minutes into the trip, surrounded by flat farmland and no significant landmarks, one of the dancers sitting on the right side of the van looked up and basked in the beautiful setting sun. Then she said, "If we're going north, shouldn't the sun be on our left side?" We were going the wrong way. Even though the evidence is staring you in the face, you don't always read the evidence correctly or even bother to think about it. If you're in a creative rut, the easiest way to challenge assumptions is to switch things around them and make the switch work. The process goes like this. 1. Identify the concept that isn't working. 2. Write down your assumptions about it. 3. Challenge the assumptions. 4. Act on the challenge. When Paul Newman first met the producers of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, the producers wanted him for the role of Sundance. Newman told them he was much more interested in the Butch role. There was a pause in the room. Everyone looked at one another. Light bulbs went off in their heads, and then they all said, "Of course, you're Butch." And that's how Robert Redford was cast as the other guy. Newman challenged the producers' assumptions by reversing them. You won't always have an outside agent in the person of a powerful star helping you reverse your way out of a rut. Most of the time you have to do it on your own. But this kind of thinking can save you. It's fitting that challenging assumptions makes light bulbs go off in people's heads. The light bulb was invented by Thomas Edison largely by challenging assumptions and ignoring, or at least tormenting, received wisdom. Lacking any formal education, which he considered his blessing, Edison approached ideas or experiences with both enthusiasm and skepticism. Edison was the master of challenging assumptions. He systematized this in his notebooks and he tested everything, including employees. Before Edison hired a research assistant, he would invite the candidate over to his lab for a bowl of soup. If the candidate seasoned the soup before tasting it, Edison would not hire the individual. He did not want people who had built so many